open up your door. It's love and joy. Let them soar, let them soar. Ramadan, Ramadan, welcome holy month, Ramadan, welcome Ramadan.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillahir Rahman al-Rahim. Brothers and sisters and dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, and we are looking at the letter written by the commander of the faithful himself to his commander Malik al-Ashtar, which contains the pinnacle and the peak of a human rights that anyone should seek. Amongst the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen commands and tells his commander to do is when it comes to trades and industries, which is an extremely vital part of any system or any government, because this is something that me and you require for our survival. So he says to him, you are advised to treat well businessmen and artisans, and direct others to do likewise. A very short line from Amir al-Mu'mineen, but yet very powerful. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, in this line, he's saying, you're going to have, or you already have businessmen and artists, but what you need to do is take care of them, treat them well, and direct others to do the same, which means you need to encourage people to become entrepreneurs. You need to encourage people to become businessmen. You need to encourage people to become tradesmen, meaning provide means of jobs for people. That is a job of the state. Now, wouldn't be that wonderful if every state that we have in this world and every system and every country tried to apply that simple line of Amir al-Mu'mineen, where they try to provide work and create business opportunities for people so these communities couldn't thrive, so we could eliminate poverty, so we could eliminate ignorance, so we can eliminate all these evil acts that happens, people only commit crimes because of ignorance or because of need. Now, if the businesses are opened and opportunities are available, then this should not happen. So even from that aspect, Amir al-Mu'minin says, it is the right of people that the state should provide them the means. Now, in a lot of countries, in order for you, sometimes you do have an opportunity to start a business. You do have a plan in mind. You know what to do, okay? And you thought of something that will give you profits. But then trying to put it into practice is where the problem comes into play. You try to get a license, and the government makes it hell for you to get a license or to get a card. You try to get a permit, and the government makes it extremely hard for you to get a permit. You want to import or transport, and they will make it extremely hard for you to bring anything into the country or take anything out of the country. They make it so hard for the common people to do businesses and trades. And why is that? Is it because they don't want you to? Or is it because they don't have the capacity? Or where the problem is? The problem is simple. They have their own businessmen who gives them revenue, so they have agreed with them that only them and them alone will be doing the trades, and they will make sure, they will make it hard for anyone to become competitors with them. So the government is winning, those businessmen who work with them are winning, and the rest of the people, me and you, are suffering. Let us take a short break, and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So Amir al-Mu'mineen advises his commander Malik to take care and treat well businessmen and create business opportunities for the common people. When he talks about artists, and he says some of those artists live in towns, and some move from one place to another. And also businessmen and trades, they do the same thing. With their ware and tools and earn their living by manual labor. Now, when we say an artist, we don't mean a painter or a person who draws. No, an artist is a musician, is an artist. A carpenter is an artist. A blacksmith is an artist. So these guys create art in many forms in throughout their labor. Some of those people, they move from one city to another looking for job opportunities to create their art. For example, even sculpturing, you know, especially back in the day when it comes to houses and creating designs and all these marvels when it comes to, in terms of statues and in terms of creating all this artwork on the walls. It was a thriving business back in the day. So those artists, they move from one place to another with their labor. So Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he says to Malik, those people need to be taken into consideration. They need to be treated well. And people need to be also pushed to go towards that direction. Which means we are trying to eliminate unemployment as much as we can. Because one of the things that the countries are suffering from today is the high rate of unemployment. And we have a high rate of unemployment is because the government are not creating, and the governments, I should say, are not creating enough job opportunities or business opportunities for people to work. If we open job opportunities for people and create, for example, centers for them to learn the arts, those people themselves, once they become employed and they create a business, they will hire many people and so on and so forth. So that will actually help the nation thrive rather than go backwards. So the Imam says to him, they are those people, businessmen or artists, are the real source of profit to the state and provider of consumer goods. At the end of the day, those businessmen or artists are those who create, create art for us in different forms that we need. In even, let's say, IKEA, for example, is also a form of art when it comes to the furniture. At the end of the day, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, they not only benefit the state by giving them taxes, but also they provide consumer goods that I and you, at the end of the day, I'm going to need a house, I'm going to need a furniture, I'm going to need a car, I'm going to need utensils, I'm going to need, kitchenware, I'm going to need a lot of things. And these things requires people who sit and design, people who create, people who make, people who manufacture. So they are all required. In this way, poverty gets eliminated. Justice is applied. Society thrives. Human rights, as we can see it, will be protected and people will live a happy life just by looking at one side of the coin. We'll leave it here and we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala محمد وآله.
Communicate.
As Yemen marks the 7th anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led bombings, there's a silent killer in Yemen that no one is talking about, the blockade. The Saudi-led coalition has imposed a siege on Yemen, preventing fuel ships from docking in the port of Hodeidah. This has caused fuel prices to skyrocket. People can't afford cooking gas, electricity. The country's inflation has gone ballistic, and the poorest country on earth is being forced to pay hundreds of millions of dollars extra for fuel for absolutely no reason. Now, the Saudis claim that there is no embargo on Yemen. They say that Yemenis are free to import food and all sorts of commodities, but the part that they leave out is that they're not letting Yemenis import fuel. And when there are fuel shortages, the entire economy goes down the drain. Now, what I'm about to show you here is a presentation of my own independent investigative journalism in partnership with a Yemeni economist. He graduated from Oxford and worked at the World Bank. His name is Amir Al-Tiba, and he put together this report which shows the true extent of the Saudi embargo. This is the silent killer that no one is talking about, the silent killer that is destroying Yemen, and we're going to expose it right now. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. So before we go any further, as I said, this is an independent investigation which we released on our own. All of the data in this report, which was put together by Oxford economist Amir Al-Tiba, comes from places like the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, and other international organizations. This is on purpose to avoid anyone accusing the report or the data of being biased. And actually, that leads to the numbers being deflated. These are conservative estimates. Now, this information is, of course, very damning to Saudi Arabia, to the United States, to its allies and its backers, and people will try to discredit it. They'll try to attack its integrity. So in order to avoid just that, the data has been sourced from purely unbiased, objective international association. So just a brief recap of the situation. Yemen has been at war for 7 years, right? It's March 23rd, 2015, when Saudi Arabia begins its bombing campaign. And as a result, Yemen is one of the poorest countries in the world. 17.4 million people. So the majority of Yemen's population are food insecure. According to UNICEF, 20 million of Yemenis live in extreme poverty. Yemen experienced one of the world's worst cholera epidemics in recent history, with over 2.5 million cases. All the bombings, the famine, the disease, the destruction have led the UN to describe the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Now, the majority of Yemenis live in areas that are controlled by the government in Sana'a. In the West, they often refer to this government as the Houthis or Ansar Allah. The Saudi coalition, on the other hand, support the government in Aden, which was deposed in a coup. Now, this is officially, it's the internationally recognized government, even though it lacks popular support. And that's who Saudi Arabia, that's who the UAE, that's who the United States have been backing. And it's in order to crush the Sana'a government, where, again, it's under their jurisdiction that most Yemenis live. This Saudi-led coalition have begun bombing Yemen. Britain and the United States have profited immensely from this genocide. They've sold Saudi Arabia literally hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons and provide them with training and logistical support. You know, just this January, the Saudis bombed a prison, killing 70 people. They even disabled the entire country's internet after destroying vital infrastructure in the port city of Hodeidah. Now this week, as we said, marks 7 years since the start of the bombing campaign. People gathered in Yemen to mark a national day of resistance and show their resolve, show their resilience in the face of all this adversity. And right now, you know, what people are talking about is the fact that Yemen hit a petroleum storage facility in Saudi Arabia belonging to Aramco. This happened as the Formula One Grand Prix is taking place. And of course, while the photographs and the videos from that certainly make for interesting headlines and front pages, there is a much bigger story about Yemen that doesn't receive anywhere near as much attention. So let's say you're a fuel tanker, right? And you want to bring gasoline or you want to bring diesel to Yemen to sell it. Well, what do you do? First, you need to obtain permission from the United Nations Verification and Inspection Mechanism for Yemen, UNVIM. So this was set up to inspect vessels and their cargo. Ships headed to Yemen, they got to stop first in Djibouti. And once they pass inspection, they're issued a clearance certificate. Now, the issue is that right before they get to Hodeidah, to the port city of Hodeidah in Yemen, the Saudi Navy start detaining these ships, despite the fact that they already have clearance from the UN, right? So once they get close to Yemen, the Saudi Navy stops them and they take them to the so-called coalition holding area in the Red Sea. Now, obviously, randomly detaining ships voids the entire purpose of the UN verification. And not only that, but by detaining these fuel ships, the price of fuel goes up. Because if you fail to offload a ship's cargo, that prevents the owner of the ship from using the vessel to do other business, right? So they start losing money. And then you have to pay the owner of the chartered ship a fine. This is also known as a demurrage cost. And so in 2020, the total amount of demurrage fines because of the Saudis detaining fuel ships on the way to Yemen was $85 million. The next year, in 2021, it was $24.5 million. Now, at first sight, you might be thinking, well, that's an improvement, right? $24.5 million is a lot less than $85 million. But no, you'd be wrong. It's not an improvement. As a matter of fact, the situation got worse. In 2020, a gasoline or diesel ship would be delayed for around 61 days on average. In 2021, a ship could be expected to be detained for 85 days. So the annual average demurrage costs for just one vessel went up from $1.14 million to $1.65 million. That's a 44% increase from 2020 to 2021 on average for every ship. And who pays for this in the end? Yemenis. Yemenis, of course, at the market, at the pump. And so the only reason that the total dollar amount of demurrage fines went down from 2020 to 2021 is ironically because less ships started coming into Yemen, right? People became reluctant to even attempt bringing fuel there because it's just so difficult. So many vessels that were originally planning to go to Yemen ended up going back or docking instead in neighboring countries and selling their cargo there. And so you can see from this table how year by year, the costs get higher and higher. In 2019, the annual average demurrage costs per one ton of gasoline is around $16. Then $49 in 2020, then $165 in 2021. So in 2019, you know, a gasoline ship would be held for 23 days on average, and then in 2021, two 119 days. I mean, think about that. That's almost an entire year that a fuel ship is not allowed to move, not allowed to offload its cargo. And in some cases, there are indeed ships that have been held over a year. 219 days is just the average. And so once the ships actually reach Yemen, it gets worse. Because with this blockade, they can't go to Hodeidah port, right? So instead, they have to go offload their cargo either in Adan or in Mukalla. So in ports that are under control of the Saudi-backed government. Now, not only are these ports further away from Hodeidah, but they also slap the fuel ships with higher costs. The customs fees, commissions to the refineries, security fees, intermediary office fees, higher transport costs, transport damages, all of this adds up like you would not believe. And so if you look at the table, you see that in November 2021, this adds up to $410 extra for every ton of gasoline and $317 extra for every ton of diesel. Okay, so that's, we're talking $410 for every ton of gasoline, $317 for every ton of diesel, extra than if they had just gone to Hodeidah. So again, just look at this detour, because once the fuel trucks get going from Hodeidah to Sana'a, it's just 226 kilometers distance. Or let's say Aden to Hodeidah, which is usually a 430 kilometer drive. But now, the fuel trucks have to take this enormous detour. So this obviously increases the cost of transportation so much because the trucks have to travel a further distance, increase their fuel consumption, and other incurred fees and potential breakage costs. So again, just to recap, the fuel ships come to ports controlled by the Saudi-backed government. They have to pay higher taxes, then higher transportation costs because the journey is longer. And on top of that, you have the roadblocks. So all along this yellow route, you have various militias, various armed groups, including Al-Qaeda, that set up checkpoints. And so when the fuel trucks try to pass, they shake them down for money, right? If the drivers don't pay up, they get killed. And so other militias that are also affiliated with the Southern Transitional Council are involved. You know, one checkpoint will add 5% to the pump price, another 10% here, another 5% there. And so you've got about 50 checkpoints with groups that are looking to make a quick buck. And who pays for this? Again, it's the Yemeni civilians who have to pay the cost, the incurred cost at the pump. So because of all these obstacles, because of this embargo, you know, people are discouraged to bring fuel ships at all to Yemen. So in 2020, you had a total of 73 ships that brought fuel to Hodeidah. The following year, 5 ships. 5 fuel ships. Came to Hodeidah in 2021. That is a 60% decrease. Do you know how many fuel ships have come so far to Hodeidah this year in 2022? One. Literally just one. So not only is the fuel in Yemen more expensive, but it's not even enough. It doesn't suffice. And so when it comes to oil derivatives, there was a deficit of 49% in local consumption. Okay? So what does that mean? That means that Yemenis only consumed half the oil that they actually need in all of 2020. Okay, so in 2020, Yemen needed 1.3 million metric tons of gasoline. They only got half, a 49% deficit in gasoline and diesel. In 2021, a 90% deficit, 90. So even if Yemenis could afford the oil, there's not enough coming in. And so like all countries that are impacted by sanctions, this embargo has led to the creation of a black market. And while the official prices for oil are low, well, there simply isn't any oil to sell. That means that consumers have to turn to the black market, where price gouging is rampant. People are forced to pay several times over what they normally would out of pure necessity. So just to give you an idea how bad this is, during the first 5 months of 2021, the price of oil on the black market went up 90% each month on average. So again, look at this graph. You can see the monthly average of gasoline prices in Sana'a per liter per riyal. And you can see the monthly average of diesel prices as well. And so in the first 5 months of 2021, the price on the black market, which is in red, it just climbs and climbs and climbs and keeps climbing. Now you can imagine what this increase this steep increase in fuel prices ends up doing to the people in Yemen, to Yemen's agriculture, Yemen's industry, Yemen's service sectors. This also means that you end up with oil derivatives that are of poorer quality because they're not controlled by the authorities. So they not only cost more, but they're also damaging the environment. They're damaging the consumers. They're damaging property and equipment. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Amir El-Tibah is the Yemeni economist who compiled all of this data, who did this brilliant job. He helped me put together this report. Amir studied in the United Kingdom. He's an Oxford graduate, and he used to work at the World Bank. He's been a country economist for almost 30 years now. He's based in Sana'a, and we spoke earlier about this report and the effects of the siege in more detail. Amir, thank you for coming on the program and taking the time to sit down and go through this with me. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure and honor to speak to you.
Amir, let's start from the beginning. Let's explain the chain of events. Basically, there are ships that are carrying fuel coming to Yemen, but they don't actually come straight to Yemen. They get stopped first. Why do they get stopped?
First, we will have to say, I mean, this is commercial imports are done by the private sector. So the public sector here, the government, have no foreign reserves or have currencies, and they cannot finance the import bill. So everything has to be done through the private sector. And then in order to qualify or to be able to submit or to purchase a fuel vessel, you have to first pay for the 100% in advance for the cost of the shipment. Once the importer overcomes these restrictions, the fuel be purchased from UAE. This is the facts that kept from the public. Once the fuel departs from UAE and heads to Yemen, to Hodeidah port, it gets redirected to Djibouti port, where the fuel has to be inspected and verified by the UN verification inspection mechanism. This is a new body, a UN body, which was created as a result of the Security Council resolutions. And there, the fuel and the entire the paperwork for the vessel and the content of the vessel will be inspected. And after that, once the fuel is inspected and cleared by the UN, the fuel would leave the port of the vessel would leave the port of Djibouti, heading towards Hodeidah, and there the vessel will be stopped and detained by warships of the coalition, and then taken to detention area near Jazan port in Saudi Arabia. There, there is always an excuse or a justification for why ships are detained. Each day would cost would add $20,000 worth of delay or demurrage fees onto the final cost of the fuel. Some of them are permitted to enter Hodeidah eventually, but then only when the total cost of the fuel is much, much more than the real cost of that day. This had huge consequences on the prices. I mean, we've had a severe fuel shortages and very flourishing black markets for smuggled fuel throughout, I mean, during the conflict since 2015. But last year, the problem became much, much worse. To put it in figures, last year, only five ships were allowed to enter Hodeidah eventually throughout. I mean, five fuel vessels of diesel and gasoline.
So basically, you end up with a situation where the necessary fuel consumption for the whole year, only a tiny fraction is actually coming through Hodeidah, but the majority is coming through the land ports, right? And who controls the land ports?
This was not very common before 2021, but since 2021, suddenly, because vessels would not be allowed to enter through Hodeidah, and then this would eventually create so much resentments and frustration by the public, in addition to the suffering and shutdowns and suspensions by several sectors in the economy. So eventually, I think starting from April last year, the authorities here started to regulate and allow fuel supply from Aden and from other ports controlled by the government in Aden. Eventually, the additional cost added onto this fuel was not big, but it just gradually increased and became bigger and bigger until now. The added cost amounts to almost 60% more than the cost of fuel imported through Hodeidah.
Right.
So this is an additional inflationary effect, which has an impact on everything. But also because of the inflated cost of transport and because of this roadblocks, where each fuel tanker will have to be stopped and will have to pay informal levies to mostly armed militia groups. Some are affiliated with the government in Aden, some are not. This is not really shocking or surprising or a new phenomenon. We've seen this in South Sudan, we've seen it in so many different countries. It's really it's financing and providing finances to armed groups, which will definitely prolong the conflict and fuel violence throughout Yemen. So
does that include Al-Qaeda as well?
Absolutely. This has been recognized and publicized by activists in the north and the south.
In the report, we saw that in 2021, the direct financial losses because of this increase in oil prices and oil derivatives, gasoline and diesel, was $644.4 million. So, just to get this straight, does that mean that people in Yemen in 2021 they paid an extra $644 million, or because of this increase in oil prices and the lack of oil, it caused the infrastructure and the state and businesses to lose money? Just to be clear,
this is how much the population, not the entire population even. This is how much the population under the in areas and markets controlled by the Sana market, we're talking about 25 million, between 23 to 25 million people paid, as an addition on their fuel prices. So this is not counting the damage estimates or financial losses in direct or indirect suffered by the economy or the infrastructure. This is how much the citizens of the poorest people in the world had to pay extra to get their fuel in 2021.
I wanted to talk to you about the difference in prices. We can see how in Rial, the price of oil and oil derivatives is completely wild. We have a Su'al Aswad, which is the black market. We have Tijara, which is the private sector in this case, and then the Rasmi, which is the official price. My understanding was that the official price, it stayed low for as long as it could, but there's no oil. And then in the black market, there is oil, but the price skyrockets, of course, and then you have a lot of people making money off of that, right?
Yes. So the official price, this is for fuel imported through Hodeidah. And this is the most affordable and source for fuel, even before the current restrictions. The commercial fuel or the commercial price is for fuel which is sourced from the port of Aden or Mukalla. So this is supplied by land but imported by the private sector through the port of Aden and or the port or other ports controlled by the government in Aden. And just to add another fact, now the blockade and this inspection and verification mechanism for Hodeidah port, this is only capable for Hodeidah port. But if you are importing fuel or any commodities through other Aden controlled ports, there is no such a thing. So you don't have to go through this very long and costly process. You don't have to be detained. You don't have to pay extra money for delay. And the irony of this is that most of the smuggling, including smuggled fuel, comes from those territories. Right? They're not under any supervision. And this is just another aspect of this politicized blockade.
This siege has resulted in a decline in purchasing power of Yemeni households who are now left unable to cover their basic necessities even more than before, from electricity to cooking gas. In Yemen, there are 0 hours of electricity. What most people have to get are solar panels or private grids, and the cost is astronomical. That cost is directly linked to the cost of fuel in the black market. In a statement, the Federation of Yemeni Private Hospitals said that, quote, blocking fuel from entering Yemen has caused the death of many patients in intensive care units, emergency and operations departments, as well as the hospital's inability to save and store medicines for chronic diseases. Now, every year a donor conference is held and all these countries get together. This year they actually couldn't even meet the goal that they had pledged to help Yemen. You know, they keep throwing money at the problem, but this doesn't fix anything. The inflation in Yemen has skyrocketed to not 1%, not 10%, 40% in 2021. Agriculture, industry, service sector, everything has been disrupted. Everything is more expensive as a direct result. And the Saudi-backed government appears to have a vested interest in blocking fuel shipments to Hodeidah. It gets to tax the population, and then on the flip side, provide Yemenis with nothing, right? They claim to be the legitimate government of Yemen, and they're in charge of all the reserves, the crude, the central bank, and yet they pay no public salaries. You know, they move the central back to Aden, but pay no salaries to public employees and servants. They pay no public salaries, but want to tax the population nonetheless. Now, there's no question the bombings in Yemen need to stop immediately, and the aid is good, but it won't solve the crisis. What Yemen needs is for the siege to be lifted. This siege is man-made. It's completely unnecessary and killing Yemenis on an unimaginable scale. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
In the Biden administration, too many unjust anti-immigrant policies remain, and thousands of immigrants are paying the price. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Rebecca Talbot and Panguit Tsoklas, writers. This article is published under the heading, ICE Continues to Abuse and Traumatize Under Biden. Here's the story. Just after dawn of September 16, 2021, EE and six other African immigrant men were resting in their bunks at the Glades County Detention Center in Moorhaven, Florida, when Captain John Gatson and a group of at least 15 sheriff's deputies stormed in, as reporters said, pepper spraying them in the eyes before dragging them to solitary confinement cells. EE and others sat in solitary with pepper spray burning their skin, prohibited from showering until the next day. On September 17th, EE received paperwork with charges, but someone else's name was on it. 9 days later, he and others finally
had a hearing. They learned Glades would keep them in solitary for 30 days, the maximum time allowed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement Policy under the Department of Homeland Security. "We are being targeted," wrote EE in a formal complaint to the DHS Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. Conditions in DHS immigration prisons have been under scrutiny the entire 20 years of ICE's existence, just as the agency's predecessors has also experienced critiques, arguably all the way back to Ellis Island in 1890s. But there are major differences under ICE, namely the massive scale of detention, both in the number of people and the amount of time they are held. This has resulted in a major upsurge in national and international interest and outrage over the immigration policies that have become a defining characteristic of the United States, right alongside its unmatched behemoth of a prison system. Groups that may have previously focused on reforms and piecemeal improvements via legislation and litigation are joining in the call for a complete shutdown of ICE detention centers. Nonpartisan groups like ACLU have joined much smaller and often grassroots, volunteer-led organizations issuing powerful statements such as this one from September 2021 by ACLU campaign strategist Isra Checker that said, "In the Biden administration, too many unjust anti-immigration policies remain, and thousands of immigrants are paying the price." Checker noted that until 1980s, most immigrants were not detained while navigating the legal process, but today, detention has become the norm rather than the exception. The reason has become painfully obvious to most anyone who takes a look, including the Government Accounting Office, GAO, which issued a report on ICE detention in February 2021. The report notes that of the $3.14 billion provided to operate its immigrant prisons, hundreds of millions in public dollars are wasted on empty beds, often being paid for under the terms of private contracts. These profiteering interests operate over 70% of ICE facilities, and they lobby hard to keep them open. Citing a similar profit motive in March 2021, Representative Ilhan Omar led a letter to President Biden's Director of Domestic Policy Susan Rice and Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas calling for an end to ICE contracts with local jails and prisons, saying, "Some of the worst examples of abuse and retaliation against detained immigrants during the COVID-19 pandemic occurred in jails and prisons operated by localities." In 2018, the Vera Institutes in Our Backyard series, which took a close look at the financing of jails and prisons around the United States, did a deep dive into the history of one such local facility contracting with ICE in Glades County, Florida. The history and present-day happenings at Glades reflect a much bigger picture of abuse and corruption at all levels, but also of the resistance that is bringing urgent changes to the immigrant detention policies for this country.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the Palms. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Alhamdulillah rabbil alameen that we've been given this opportunity to gather once more and take little reminders to help and aid us through the day when we feel like we need a little pick-me-up or a little supplement to, in order to better navigate and be better people. Life is hard. There's no doubt about it. There's no questioning the fact that life is legit hard, and often people make it harder. No one can deny it. It's an experience that we go through since the very moment that we're born. There's always a struggle, there's always a fight, there's always something that we are grappling with, wrestling with, trying to overcome, trying to move past. And it's part of the journey, basically, and it's inevitable, and we just have to accept it. But it becomes intolerably hard when we feel that this pain and these difficulties and hardships that we go through in life are in vain and have no meaning. I think a writer or philosopher once said this, I don't remember who, pardon my faulty memory, that any hardship is bearable as long as it has meaning. And the older I get, the more true that sounds, the more true that feels. Let's listen to a short anecdote about life's hardship, and we'll be right back.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Almighty. Dear brothers and sisters, salam. So welcome to another episode of Lantern with a nice story. Growing deep and strong is the title of today's story. I invite you to listen to it. One day my mother and I were working together in the garden where we were transplanting plants for the third time. Growing from seed in a small container, the plants had been transferred to a larger container, then transplanted into the garden. Now, because I was moving, we were transplanting them once again, inexperienced as a gardener. I turned to my green-thumbed mother. Isn't this bad for them? I asked, as we dug them up and shook the dirt from the roots. Won't it hurt these plants being uprooted and transplanted so many times? Oh, my mother replied, transplanting doesn't hurt them. In fact, it's good for the ones that survive. That's how their roots grow strong. Their roots will grow deep and they will make strong plants. Often I felt like those small plants uprooted and turned upside. Sometimes I've endured the change willingly, sometimes reluctantly, but usually my reaction has been a combination. Won't this be hard on me? I ask. Wouldn't things be better if things remained the same? That's when I remember my mother's words. That's how the roots grow deep and strong.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Another aspect that I feel difficulties and hardships helped me strengthen my roots in was humility. And it gave me a sense of humbleness. It gave me a sense of, well, anything can happen to anyone at any point. Then what's the point of being arrogant and proud and feeling yourself high and mighty and above other people when all of this could be taken away in a blink of an eye and there's nothing you can do about it? And once I developed that sort of humility in myself and got a real, you know, strong dose of reality, I think I became more compassionate toward others. I think I became less fussy about life circumstances. I think I freaked out less when, you know, ups and downs of life occurred. I became more confident. I became more calm because I knew that, you know, this is all life is about. It's not a big deal. When I was younger, if I was faced with obstacles and, you know, mountain peaks and valleys, it legit freaked me out. And I thought to myself, oh, well, why does this have to happen to me? How am I going to handle this? This is so inconvenient. This is so uncomfortable. This is so difficult, yada, yada, yada. But now life's knocked me down so many times that I know better than to complain about these inevitable phenomena. And I've realized that, you know, I'm nothing special. This happens to everyone. Worse things have happened to better people. It's all a part of life. It's a learning journey. It depends on how I look at it. I can either bellyache and complain and nag and rant my way through this, or I can accept it, come to terms with it, rely on Allah for help and guidance and strength, and weather the storm. Either way, I have to put myself through this. And that definitely strengthened my roots as a person, individually, and as how I treat other people. I most definitely freak out less regarding the hardships of my loved ones as well. There was perhaps a point in my life if someone I loved, a friend or family or someone I even knew, was going through some hard times, I would feel physically restless because I didn't want them to be suffering. I didn't want them to struggle. I didn't want them to be sad. But now I feel like, eh. I mean, I'm sorry that you're going through that. I really am. If there was anything I could do to stop it, I still would. But at the end of the day, you live, you learn. And all of this is strength. All of this is strength. And all of this builds me. And when our roots are strong, we can see its effect in every aspect of our being. It is the tree with the strong roots that can have branches that reach out to the sky. Strong, sturdy trunk that people can lean on, depend on. Foliage and leaves that people can sit beneath its shades, and beautiful blossoms and fresh, colorful fruits. It'll all be worth it. Don't worry. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
Aperture. Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died, and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's University Hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass